Rabbi Center, first of all, I greatly appreciate the yeshiva welcoming me, and Rabbi Center especially was very, very, very hospitable and really went to great extents to help the shmuz and help me. Thank you. Shusam Hellas Yeshiva. One of the greatest Tanaic personalities, one of the greatest Gedolim of his time, was Elisha ben Avuya. And while Elisha ben Avuya began as a Tana, who was the Rebbe of Rebbe Meir, he had began as the shining light of the Klal Yisrael, one of the Sari HaTorah. His end was not quite so beautiful. The Gemara Chagiga tells us, Dalet nechnesu lepardes. There were four people who left the physical constraints of this world, saw Kadosh Baruch Hu as much as a human being can while he's still alive. They were Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Rabbi Kiva, and Elisha ben Avuya. It was Yom Kippur, it was Shabbos. After decades of preparing themselves, they engaged in a process of ispashtas agashmis, literally leaving physicality behind. They said the Shema Mefurash, and they went to Shemayim. But it didn't end so well. Ben Zoma died. Ben Azai died. Ben Zoma became insane. Elisha ben Avuya became an apikoris. And Rabbi Kiva alone was Yotza B'Shalom. And the Rasha explains to us what happened. We have a very cavalier attitude. You know, Hashem, we daven to Hashem. Hashem is here. As I speak to you, I speak to Hashem. Hashem and I were tight. We're buddies. The Rasha explains, if we had an inkling to covet Shemayim, if you can imagine thousands and thousands and thousands of groups, each group containing millions of malachim, some of these groups are zocha to say Shira once a week. Thousands upon thousands of groups, each containing millions of malachim, are only zocha to say Shira to Hashem once a month. Entire legions are only zocha to say Shira once a year. Entire cadres of malachim, huge, huge groups, multitudes of them, are only zocha to say Shira to Hashem once every 500 years. And if you can imagine in the center of the Kisei HaKavod and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the creator of the heavens and the earth, maintainer of everything, sits there. When these four people went there, explains Masha, and as I said, it's too much. I don't want anything to do with the physical world. He saw Hashem, he saw the beauty, and he was so drawn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he said, I don't want to come back. He died. Ben Zoma was too much, short-circuited, was an overload, became insane. Elisha ben Avuya saw two Rishuyas. What does that mean? If it could be in some way, he saw as if there were two Hashems. Rabbi Kiva alone went as far as a human being could and was Nichnas B'Shalom. When Elisha ben Avuya came down, he made a fatal decision. That's it. I'm done. He became a complete Abikoris. It was still Shabbos, it was still Yom Kippur. He got on a horse and he began riding. And he heard a basko come out from the Kodshi Kodshim, Shuvu Vonim Shovavim. Return, my children, return. Chutz, me Elisha ben Avuya. Sheyada bi umarad bi. Says HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he knew me. You were a Tana. And you were Nichnas Lefnai Lefnim. For you to become an Abikoris is so severe. Shuvu Vonim Shovavim doesn't apply to you. Says Elisha ben Avuya, if I don't have an Olam Haba, nope. Might as well have an Olam Hazeh. He walked over to a prostitute and he propositioned her. And she said the words, what? Aren't you Elisha ben Avuya, the great Tana? Aren't you the famous Talmud Chacham? It was Shabbos, it was Yom Kippur. He reached into the ground, pulled out a radish, and she said the words, Acherhu, it's somebody else. From that moment on, he's no longer called Elisha ben Avuya. Throughout the Mishnayos, throughout the Gemara, the name Elisha ben Avuya doesn't appear again. He's called Acher. Her name stuck. Needless to say, very quickly the Klal Yisrael realized that he wasn't the man he used to be, and they were poorish from him, except for one person. There was one person who felt that there was still so much amkus, so much yediyas haTorah, so much emes within him in terms of knowing Hashem, that person still remained a Talmud. That was Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir remained a Talmud. Rabbi Meir went to learn from him. Rabbi Meir felt he could be dole, he could take out the truth and throw away the psolus. Rabbi Meir alone remained a Talmud. And this went on for quite a while. The Gemara tells us one event in the sequence of events. A while later, it's also a Shabbos. Rabbi Meir is walking next to his Rebbe. His Rebbe's riding on a horse. And at a certain point, Acha from the top of the horse says, Meir, Chazor Bucha, Meir return. Farshiarti Bikvei Susi, already measured with the steps of my horse. Ad Kan Tchum Shabbos. The Tchum is here. Stop. Interesting that Acher from on top of the horse has a better grip on Tchum Shabbos than Reb Meir. But when Reb Meir heard the words Chazor Bacha, he used a play on words, V'Rebbe V'Ata Chazor, why don't you return? Kfar Amarti Lecha, says Elisha Revuya, I already told you, Shemati Me'achari Apargud, I heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself say, Shuvu Vanim Shovim Chutz Min Elisha Revuya. And he lived out his days as Acher. No longer Elisha ben Avuya, but Acher. At the very end of his days, a messenger comes running to Rabbi Meir. Your Rebbe is on his deathbed. Your Rebbe is dying. Rabbi Meir goes running. He goes running and he sees Acher is about to leave this earth. And he says, now do tshuva. Says Acher, will they accept me now in tshuva? Rabbi Meir quotes a pasuk, yes they will. Hischa livchos. Acher begins crying. The Simach Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was joy-filled. Rabbi Meir assumed that those tears were tears of tshuva, and he assumed that he had charata. But apparently Rabbi Meir was wrong. Because they buried Acher, everyone went home, and another messenger came back to bring the message. Rabbi Meir, Sarav Kever Rabcha, the Kever of your Rebbe is burning. And when Rabbi Meir ran back to the kever, he saw a pillar of flame was burning the grave. He took off his talus and put out the fire. And Chazal tells us that at that moment there was a tumult in Shemayim. And the tumult went something like this. Lo ladayni ladine v'lo la'asid la'alma. He's not allowed into Gehenim. He's not allowed into Gan Eden. He's not allowed into Gehenim. Mishum da'asak baraisa. He learned. He's not allowed into Gan Eden Mishum Dechata because he sinned. Acher was supposed to remain in limbo, not in Gan Eden, not in Gehenim, forever. For eternity, he was supposed to remain nowhere, just hanging. Apparently, Rabbi Meir understood this. And Rabbi Meir was Mavakish Rachamim. Please, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, let him into Gehenim. At least it'll clean up. And at least what's left, he'll be able to enjoy in Gan Eden. Rabbi Meir was Mavakish Rachamim day after day, going to Telfin. And finally, Rabbi Meir said the words, Masai Amos, when will I die? Va'ala Oshan Mikivro, and I'll bring a pillar of smoke up from his kever, a sign that he's accepted into Gehenim. Gemara tells us that the day Rabbi Meir died, a pillar of smoke began rising from the kever of Acher. That pillar of smoke remained day after day, week after week, month after month, until years later, Rabbi Yochanan comes and says, what good did Rabbi Meir accomplish? Very nice, you brought him into Gehenim. But it's years later and he's still there. Says Rabbi Yochanan, Masai Amos, when will I die? And I'll stop the pillar of smoke. Gemara tells us the day Rabbi Yochanan died, the pillar of smoke stopped. And at the Levaya of Rabbi Yochanan, they said, Hespid, who is like you, Rabbi Yochanan, even the Shomer Pesach Gehenim? Even the guardsmen of Gehenim can't tell you what to do. It was understood that Rabbi Yochanan took Acher out of Gehenim into Gan Eden. And let's stop for a moment and focus on the Kofei Oris question. Rabbi Meir understood something, that Acher was supposed to be in limbo. And Rabbi Meir davened, please Hashem, please have Rachamim, let him go to Gehenim. Now, I was a high school Rebbe for many years. The idea of a Talmud being the spallo that his Rebbe should go to Gehenim wasn't that foreign to me. I get it. But this is Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir's Mivakish, Hashem, please have Rachmanis. Hashem, please let him burn in Gehenim. We have any Sephardim in the audience here? Good, Baruch Hashem. Ashkenazim, I'm not allowed to talk about Gehenim. Oh, now but you're going to scare us, Gehenim. Don't say the words. All right. So, we're here. We have a personal conversation over here. Okay. We don't talk about Gehenim. But what is Gehenim? Imagine the following, and you'll excuse me for saying it this way. Your mother asks you to take the challah out of the oven on Erev Shabbos. So you do the typical yeshivish trick. You take a yarmulke and you pull the metal grate out with it, right? But foolishly you use a yarmulke, first of all. But secondly, you miss a little bit and your thumb catches right on the hot metal rod. Ah! One little digit, one little part of your finger. You're not going to sleep that night. There was a bonfire in camp, and some guys were too close to the fire, and the council kind of walked close to pull him away, but he tripped, and he landed palm first into the hot coals. A softball-sized blister, the screaming, you can't imagine. But again, it's a small little part. How much flesh? Imagine you're in the shower, and it's Erev Shabbos, it's hot water, and you have soap in your eyes, and it's just too hot, and you reach for the cold, but by mistake, you turn on more hot. Ah! At least we're dealing with your body, your skin exposed. But that's not an inkling to what Gehenim is. If you want to know what Gehenim is like, take a matchbox car. You know those little kids' cars, tiny little car? Turn it over, and you'll see 1/60th scale model. Meaning that little matchbox car is 1/60th of a full car. Take the 2 inches and multiply it out by 60, it's 5 feet long. Take this little 2-inch car and multiply it exponentially by 60, and it's a 5,000-pound SUV. Chazal tell us, take the hottest fire you can imagine. Take a kiln, heat it up to 4,000 degrees, and multiply that by 60. That's the Eish HaGehenim. Gentlemen, I don't know if you know what I'm saying here, but Chazal say Gehenim is not measured out in months. It's not meted out in weeks. Not even in hours. It's in seconds. The incredible amount of busha. You see, here, we're deadened. We don't appreciate it. But in a moment of flashing clarity, I get it. Hashem was present in every moment of my existence. And while Hashem was right there, while Hashem was keeping my hand in existence, I took my very hand that Hashem created, was holding, and I took and I slapped him, kaviyachol, in the face. The bush is so incredible. The incredible pain, if you take a fire, the most hottest fire you can imagine, multiplied by 60, it will not give you a clue to what it's like being there. The Kochvayor does the math for us. From the death of Rebbe Meir until the death of Rebbe Yochanan was at least 130 years. So here's the question. How could Rebbe Meir be Mevakesh Rachem? Hashem, please have Rachem on us. We could ask because we don't know what Gehenim is. But whether Rebbe Meir was Sephardi or Ashkenazi, he was strong enough to deal with reality. And he fully well knew what Gehenim was. And he knew that Acher might be in Gehenim for who knows how long. In the end, it was 130 years. How could you call that Rachamim? And I think the answer to this question is based on understanding the other side of the equation. And to understand that other side, I hope you guys are forgiving me for asking a relevant question. Here's the question. The question goes like this. How good is Hashem at doing that which Hashem does? Right? How capable is Hashem? How good is Hashem at doing that which Hashem does? So, if you're not really sure, let's focus on a couple of facts. You know, the universe we live in is made up of 100 billion galaxies, each one containing 100 billion stars. Each one is hot as the sun or hotter. The brain that you're thinking with right now is made of 100 billion neurons. Somehow, the electrical signals know to go this way and that way, and they don't cross and get all jumbled and you start just seizing up. A cell, one cell of the human body, is more complex than New York City. Look out at the sky, the sun, the moon, the stars. Watch a seed suddenly bloom and form into an orange tree or an apple tree. Watch grass grow. Watch a cow grow. Study any facet of this world, and you'll quickly see that Hashem is very, very good at doing that which Hashem does. Okay. That being said, let's imagine we'll need the following. What would be if Hashem created a world for one reason? What would be if Hashem created a world for strictly one reason? For you to have Hana. Now again, assuming that Hashem is quite capable, and He made an entire world strictly for you to have pleasure. And there'll be pleasures within pleasures, whiffs within whiffs, and layers upon layers of unending, unceasing pleasure. But without the troubles and the worries and the daigas and the constant being pulled, one day being into it, one day being out of it, without the constant conflict. Could you imagine if Hashem created such a world? Well, good morning. That's called Olam Haba. You see, it's not that Rabbi Meir didn't understand Gehenna. He understood it very, very well. But he understood the other side of the equation. He understood that when Acher's done, whatever he's done with, forever and ever, that means for eternity, he goes to Gan Eden, and that's where he sits, and the pleasure there is so immense, to be able to be dovik to the Shechina, to be close to Hashem, and even those are just words to us now, but there's a tremendous pull within the human, a tremendous drive, and without the trappings of physicality, it's the greatest pleasure imaginable, so great that it was worthy to suffer 130 years or more, and that's why Rabbi Meir davened for Rachman. And I think this is an interesting illustration of what Gan Eden is like. And if your friend says to you one day, you know, my life is Gehenim, Mom is Gehenim. And what he means is because you had to have hamburgers again that night instead of steak. You say to him, I hear you. Your suffering is acute. And my heart feels for you. But I'm sure that it's worth it. And gentlemen, I think what this Chazal is sharing with you is the fact that as much as we suffer today, and I don't mean to make light, because there are people who do suffer, if you take the worst existence you could ever imagine, I guarantee it pales in comparison to a moment in Gehenna, surely 10 years, surely 130 years, yet it was worth it. So this Musag, this concept, I think is relevant and important to know. But there are bigger lessons for us to learn. Let's start with one interesting part of this Gemara. Acher dies. Rabbi Meir goes to the kever, the fire comes down, he extinguishes the fire with his talus. And at that moment, there's a tumult in Shemayim. L'l'dayni l'dini, he can't be allowed into Gehenim. L'l'asi l'alma, he can't be allowed into Gan Eden. Now, why he can't go into Gan Eden, I understand. Mishum d'chata. Whatever he accomplished as Elisha Menavuya, the rest of his life, he was Acher. I got that. But why can't he go into Gehenim? So Chazal say, Mishum de Osak Baraisa, he was involved in Torah study. And the Marsha helps us a little bit, because the Marsha adds words, Schus at Torah Mogin, and the Schus of Limud Torah protected him. Now, the question I think you should ask is, this sounds very difficult. Anything the man accomplished, anything he did, he turned against. Anything he did as Elisha ben Avuya, he undid as Acher. What do you mean, Schus at Torah Mogin? And if you'd like to understand this, I'll share with you an interesting little observation. There's a fellow whose name is Drayman. Drayman is the lead guitarist for, lead singer, I'm sorry, for Disturbed, a rock group named Disturbed. Now, I've never heard them, but it's been told to me that they well deserve the title Disturbed. Okay, in any case, the reason I mention that is not because I've ever heard him, nor do I know much about him, but I do know one fact about him. He began as a yeshiva bacher. He was learning in Chavetz Chaim, Milwaukee branch. And apparently he went off, and quite off, and he, whatever. Okay, now, we're almost followed the Teshuva, come back and live a very good, proper life, but Rachman Tzlan, and again, it shouldn't happen, but let's say it's over. Done. Toast. Today it's done. And he stands in front of the Beis Din Shamala. Now, needless to say, the body piercings and the tattoos aren't going to be there because the body's put in the kever. But if he stands in front of Hashem, what if I share with you the following? The fact that when he was 6 years old, he learned a pasuk in Chumash. The fact that when he was 8, he learned Mishnayos. The fact that when he was 10, he started Gemara. And when he was 13, he learned Eli Metzius, is his schus forever. You see, the Marsha explains, it's not so simple, but all mitzvahs, if you're Toa al Rishonis, if you regret doing them, you could lose them. With one exception, Limud HaTorah. It doesn't matter even if you turn against it, even if you say, drat, I wasted my time, I wish I hadn't, you can't undo it, and it's yours forever. And again, this fellow Drayman, whatever level it's on, he'll probably come back and kiss the shoes of his Rebbe who made him, against his will, learn that Tosos. But gentlemen, the point here, I think, is very, very powerful. There are many, many things that a person goes through in life, and the only schus that remains yours forever is the time you spent in front of that Gemara, the time you spent in front of a Chumash with Rashi, the time you spent learning is your eternal reward, and nothing that you do after can remove it from you. It's yours forever. But that's really not the major point here. It's many years later that we find out the rest of the story. It was many years later when Bito Shel Acher, the daughter of Acher, comes in front of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. And she says the words, Rebbe Parnaseni. Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, as a Nasi, part of his responsibilities was to give out tzedakah funds. She said, Rebbe Parnaseni, please give me an allocation. He said, Biti Miat, who are you? I'm the daughter of Acher. What, says Yehuda ben Asi? Is there anyone left from his lineage? It's not Shaykh. Zachot Taroso Valtiskor Maisav, please remember his Torah, don't remember his actions. Sechazal Miyad, immediately, Yarda Eishim Neshamayim, a pillar of fire came down from Shemayim and burnt the chair that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi was sitting on. He fell to the ground and began crying. Im lemizganim bokach, if this is the way they stand up for the honor of a Talmud Chacham, that's an embarrassment to the Torah. How much more so do they stand up for the honor of a Talmud Chacham who's an honor to the Torah? And here's the question. I get the scene. A woman comes in, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi doesn't know who she is. Who are you, the daughter of Acher? What? Is there anyone left in the world? Please remember his Torah, don't remember his Maisim. And a fire comes down from Shemayim. Okay, I get it all. What I don't understand is, why is Rabbi Yehuda Anasi crying? Okay, he understands that whatever the reason, they stood up for the covet of Rabbi Yehuda, of this Acher. Even though he's an embarrassment of the Torah, so why is he crying? You'd like to know why he's crying? Because of a different question the Mashiach asks. The Mashiach asks, what is Rabbi Yehuda Anasi's big tema? In walks this woman, and he says, who are you, Acher? Is there anyone left from his lineage? Says the Mashiach, what's the big question? There are plenty of Rishonim who had children, and grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Look throughout the millennium. Look at Nebuchadnezzar. Look at Par. You don't hear that Rishonim don't have children or grandchildren. What is the big question that so plagues Rabbi Yehuda Anasi? And explains the Mashiach, Efshir, it's possible that he was the worst human being who ever lived. Didn't you hear what Chazal said in the beginning of the Baskol? Yoda bi umorad bi. Says Hashem, he knew me. He was nichnas lepardes. Normally a person rebels against Hashem because of taiva, kavod, whatever the reasons may be. But this was a Tana. He understood everything. He understood Hashem and recognized Hashem's presence. For him to rebel, says Mashiach Efshir, it's possible he was the worst Rasha in the course of humanity. And if you'd like to know who Acher was, the Gemara explains to us. The Romans at the time already occupied our land. And the Romans did everything in their powers to get the Jews to leave their religion. And on Shabbos, the Romans would organize work camps. They would gather the Jews and make the Jews mechallel Shabbos. Whatever the Jews could do to lessen the chillul Shabbos, they did. So for instance, if there was a beam that one person could carry, they'd have two men carry it, taking it down from a deraisa to a derabbanan. If the Romans told them to carry something through a shus rabim, they'd make sure to carry it only through a karmelis, again, taking it down to a derabbanan. Whatever the Jews could do to lessen the chillul Shabbos, they did. Acher would go from work camp to work camp. Well, no. That trick with the two guys would unfold. No, make one guy carry. Oh, no, not that way. No. Make him go this way through the Rosh Hashanah. He went from work camp to work camp, making sure the Jews were Mechallel Shabbos in the most egregious manner possible. When he first came down, it took a while for the word to spread that he was no longer Elisha ben Avoya. He went to the outskirts of the Bati Midrashim, to the young Talmidim, and walked into the basement and said, you, what are you doing here? You're wasting your life. You could be a shoemaker. You could be a tailor. What are you wasting your life? They still knew him as Elisha ben Avoya. He cleared out the Bati Midrashim. Says the Yerushalmi, at the height of his rishis, biyadayim, with his hands, he choked Talmidei Chachamim. Would you like to know why Rabbi Yehuda Anasi cried? Because in one flash of reality, Rabbi Yehuda Anasi understood something that he never understood before. The kavod due to a Talmud Chacham. Meaning to say, if this is the honor, they burnt my chair because I said the word Russia. I said, is there anyone left? I insulted the honor of a Talmud Chacham. But look who he was. He became Efshir, maybe the worst Russia ever. But they still stand up for the honor of a Talmud Chacham. Says Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, Oyvei, maybe the previous years of my life I haven't treated Talmidei Chachamim with the respect due to them. Oyvei, what have I done? And he began crying. And gentlemen, if you'd like to know why I believe this is Nogea to us, there are two aspects to it. Number one is simple. Baruch Hashem, our Rebbeim, act in a very open, close manner. In Chofetz Chaim, especially the Rishiva Zatzal used to act as Machmas Anivus, Machmas Krenet Kesher, acted as close as you can imagine. I know in Rabbi Senta's Yeshiva it's the same. And it's a wonderful thing to have a Rebbe who's open and you can relate to is a beautiful thing. And you also have to remember something. At the end of the day, this man is a Talmid Chacham. At the end of the day, there's a certain honor due to him. The two sugim have mentioned in Shemayim, there's regular people and there's the group called Talmid Chacham, and the honor due to them, despite the fact that they act nicely and act like your friend and act like your buddy, you have to remember they're not your buddy. And I don't mean just about standing up when they walk into the Beis Medrash. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about understanding that this man speaks for Das Torah. That when you have a life question, you go to your Das Torah, you go to your Rebbe, and you ask, what does the Torah want from me? What is it, Derech Hashem? What does Hashem want from me? And you humbly submit your Das to your Rebbe. What that means in plain language is, if you want to know what Hashem wants, you ask Das Torah. And then whether you think you're so wise and you think you know better or not, you say, I get it. I recognize the fact that I don't know so much. I recognize the fact that I don't really understand things as well as I could. And you humbly submit your Das to Das Torah. You know, when I was first married, my wife said to me, Everything asked for a shiva? Everything? It was a few years after we were married, and my wife said to me, maybe we should go to the shiva. Why don't we ask for a shiva? And then she was the one who led the parade much more than I did. And you know why? Because when you start making life decisions and you realize, you know, I don't have that much wisdom. I haven't been about this thing called life really that long. And you recognize that there's someone who represents Das Torah, Torah wisdom, breath of knowledge, and who could guide you. You learn a little bit of humility and you humbly submit. So that's a lesson, I think. That's a big deal for us to have a Rebbe, to have Das Torah, and you machnia, you humbly submit and you listen, because this person represents the Torah, represents what Hashem wants. But there's a much bigger lesson. Chofetz Chaim in Hilchos Lashon Hara says we make a fundamental mistake. If you ask somebody today, what's a Talmid Chacham? Oh, Rebbe Gamliel, Abaye Rova, the Yavitz maybe, come together, Rebbe Hager, Chofetz Chaim, but that's it. Today, in our day and age, there's no real Talmid Chachamim anymore. Says the Chofetz Chaim, that is a fallacy. That's a to'os. If you want to know what the definition of a Talmid Chacham is, one who's yaga b'Torah, he labors in Torah, v'roi l'horos, and in his generation, he's fit to paskin. That doesn't mean he's bucking in shas and poskim. It doesn't mean he knows dalad chalki shulchan aruch backwards and forwards. It means that he's yaga b'Torah, and he has a good enough understanding to paskin. Would you like to know what it means in plain simple language? If you were bright enough to pass a ninth grade freher in a regular yeshiva, it means you're bright enough to reach that level of being a Talmid Chacham. If you're bright enough to pass a 10th grade regents, then you're bright enough to reach that level. You have the academic capacity. And gentlemen, you know what it means in plain simple language? In plain simple language, it means that you and I will meet again, Yirtzeh Hashem. Hopefully many, many years from now. Many, many years from now. And I guarantee that you and I will come to a shocking reality. In this room alone, every individual here knows at least 100, probably 500, maybe 1,000 guys. If you think about it, from the time you're in grade school, through high school, through Beis Medrash, you've come in contact with at least 1,000 guys. And I'd like to share with you, when you leave this earth, you're going to meet that group of your buddies from the old days. And there's going to be at least one or two, maybe a dozen, who are going to be shining like the brilliant sun in midday. Gigantic, phenomenal people. Forever, great beyond comparison. And you're going to say the words, what happened to you? You battled with the best of us. What happened? What happened was the guy put his brain on. And he said, I don't have to be whatever everyone else is. I don't have to accept my parents' version of me or my friend's version of me or whatever limiting belief keeps me in place. He put his brain on and started learning and learning and steiging. And I'm not discussing what he did for a living. I'm discussing what he did with his life. And I'm not telling you to learn forever, or go to work, or either, or both, or none of them. I'm talking what kind of human being you'll be. You see, gentlemen, my job is probably the worst job in the world. Most of the time, if I do my job well, I fail. See, most audiences I speak to, if I really do a good job, and I get a guy who says, yeah, right, I'm going to change, I'm really going to make a difference in my life, he's 40 years old, he's got a wife and kids, he's got to work 10, maybe 12 hours a day, and if that's not bad enough, then tax season starts, and the idea of him really making changes doesn't happen. So even if I succeed, I fail. But you guys are in a unique position of life. For many of you guys, who you will be as a human being, who you'll be as a husband, who you'll be as a father, is determined on certain decisions that you're going to make very, very shortly. Who you'll be forever will be determined by a wise decision or a foolish decision. And very often, it's frivolous and with certainly without much depth, and typically without asking Das Torah. And again, the reason why for you guys, I think the lesson here is huge, is because who you will be forever is largely shaped by certain decisions that you'll make in the course of the next coming weeks, months, certainly a year or so. But I think there really is a major part to this that I want to explain to you a little bit deeper. As I mentioned, I get to speak in a lot of different communities. And there's a certain shmooze that I no longer say. It's shmooze number 23. If you guys listen to the shmooze, it's on Kalaloshan. It's also on the... you guys don't go on the internet. If you did, you know it's on the shmooze.com. You guys certainly don't know what iPhone or Android is, but if you did, you know there's an app. Isn't that clever? You know, don't go on the internet, but if you do, go to shmooze.com. Don't get an iPhone or Android, no matter what. Even if you get the app, it's not worth it. Don't do it. Okay, but in any case, shmooze number 23, if you're familiar with it, is the death shmooze. And it's a nice shmooze. It's a fun, happy shmooze. It describes your death. What your funeral's like. You know, all your relatives coming and crying. Oh, don't cry, Aunt Sadie. It's okay. I'm just dead. You know, and it describes what it's like when they put you in the deep ground and you feel a clunk as your casket hits the bottom and you feel the dirt crash on your casket. Crash. You know, it's... Anyway, typically, when I'm done, everybody is like really... All right, so I did the shmooze, and I used to do it pretty regularly. I was always invited back. Never. Oh, let's have Rabbi Schaefer come again. He was so much fun. All right, anyway, I said it in one out-of-town community, and I saw it was very powerful, and people really moved. And a lot of people came over to me and asked questions and comment afterwards, and I noticed an older couple kind of hovering on the side. When everyone was finished their questions and they left, the older couple came by, and the woman came first, and she said, "Rabbi, I love the lecture." Thank you very much. Her husband followed suit. "Rabbi, I love the lecture, but..." Now, I've been around the block long enough to know that when you hear the words, "Rabbi, I love the lecture, but..." this is going somewhere. So I waited to see where this is going. "Rabbi, I love the lecture, but according to what you've just said, I've wasted my entire life." Now, folks, when you're on this side of the shtender, and an 80-year-old man is on the other side of the shtender saying, according to what you just said, he wastes his entire life, and you know he might be right, it's a pretty uncomfortable position to be in. So I stopped saying that shmooze in public. Okay, good. I'm really brave, right? Okay, but I do want to share with you, to understand what this man's point was, I want to share with you some highlights of, not again, I'm not going to do the death shmooze. Nobody gets, we talked about Gehenna, and we're not going to talk about death. But I want to share with you just a highlight of that shmooze. Here we go. I was a high school Rebbe for 15 years. I got guys who had been learning, you know, regular from homes, regular from background. They came to my shiur, they were already 16, 17 years of age. They knew how to learn. Pretty good in a Tosfos. Most guys could read a Mashra decently. And when it came to learning, they weren't bad, but anything outside of that, like davening or amunah, like brain dead, like flatline, like nothing. So I realized that part of my job was to teach you guys how to learn, but maybe a bigger part of my job was to teach them how to be a Jew. In any case, I devised a Musa curriculum for the Chevra. And every year, I would begin the Musa curriculum with the following question. Now, again, keep in mind, these are from guys, regular homes. I would start with the following question. I would say, "Gentlemen, tell me the following. Why don't you sin? Why don't you sin? I don't mean little stuff. I mean big deal stuff. Murder, pillage, just every avera you could ever imagine. Why don't you guys do it?" "Oh, come on, Rebbe. Hashem's going to be angry with me. I don't want Hashem to be angry with me." I say, "Listen, gentlemen. Throughout the thousands of years since Maaseh Bereishis, there have been many, many Rishayim who flourished. Don't worry about Hashem." "Oh, yeah, that's true now. But when I die, my Neshama's going to burn. I don't want my Neshama to burn." I would say, "Uh-huh. You're telling me there are many things you're going to do and many things you're not going to do, also your neshama shouldn't burn? You listen to me. You party. Do whatever you want. Why should you work so hard so your neshama should have a good time up there? You take care of you and let your neshama burn." Now, I would always say to standing by the door, No one was allowed to leave. I don't want to hear, like, 20 years later, a guy becomes a serial killer. You know, Rabbi Schaefer said, you know? Okay. But what's the answer to the question? So Rizal Salanta says, we make a fundamental mistake. We think about death of like, oh, I don't know. Like death, like, oh, black, who knows? Says Rizal Salanta, it's really very simple. If you want to understand death, it's as simple as pie. I walk in the room. I take off my coat. I'm in the room. This part, the goof, is the coat. I take it off, it's put in the ground, and I emerge. But I is me, the guy who thinks, the guy who remembers, the guy inside who tells the arms and legs to move. It's not my distant cousin, not my alter ego. But most people don't think about death that way. Most people think about death as in asleep, as in rest in peace, as in Harvey was a good man. He's in his final resting place. Rest in peace, Harvey. Now, gentlemen, listen carefully to what I'm saying to you. If you break your arm and you're in throbbing pain, ow, you take Tylenol, Percocet, nothing helps. 3 a.m., you fall asleep. Ah, Baruch Hashem, it doesn't hurt me anymore because I'm not there. If death was like going to sleep as in rest in peace, then the question I ask those guys is very valid. Who cares? Why should you learn? Why should you do mitzvahs? Why should you care? Let your neshama burn. Says Yerba Sosalanti, you only make one little mistake. You are the neshama. I am the neshama. I'm not the goof. The goof is the part that houses me. The goof is the part that I temporarily occupy. But I'm the guy inside. And even though this may sound obvious, most people don't really get this. So excuse me for giving you a mushel. Here we go. A little social etiquette. If you receive a text, how much time do you have to respond to that text and still be in the gedorim of socially polite, correct behavior? Right, from the time you get the text until you respond, what is social etiquette? Anyone know? 2 minutes? 60 seconds? 15 seconds? What do you mean you're in a shower? I texted you over 10 seconds ago. I don't give one. Okay, it's a very short window of time. I'm not sure exactly what it is. But imagine the following. You come home for Bein Hazmanim, and your kid brother just started learning how to drive. And you know your kid brother is not the most coordinated fellow in the world, but he is polite. I mean, polite as they come. And it's an Indian of Kirov, and so you're trying to spend some time with your kid brother. And so he's driving, and you're sitting next to him. And you notice that the speedometer kind of is hovering between the 80 and the 90 miles an hour. I don't want to say anything. I don't want to think I'm cool. I don't think I'm nervous. So you kind of bite your tongue, and you kind of just don't say anything as you sit there, panicking a little bit. And then suddenly, your kid brother gets a text. Well, he may not be so coordinated, but he is polite, so he texts back. Text comes in, back and forth, and back and forth, and crash, shattered glass, twisted metal, you're out cold. 3 days later, you wake up in a hospital, in a bed, and the doctor looks down and he says, son, sorry to be the one to tell you this, but you'll never move another muscle in your body again. And you feel your arms, they don't move. You feel your legs, they don't move. Not your chest, not your head. Help! I'm stuck in here! Help! And imagine it's you. Imagine you're in the hospital and you can't move. And your friends come to visit. And your friends say those things that friends say when they don't know what to say. Oh, you look terrible. Thanks a lot, guy. Not bad of a guy stuck in here. You can tell me how bad I look. Okay, here's the question. It's you in that hospital bed. Can't move your arms, can't move your legs, can't move your head, your chest. Are you alive? Are you alive? You're not sure, huh? Well, I'll share with you. There is a book called The Butterfly and the Diving Bell that was written by the editor of Elle magazine, a well-known magazine in France. He was in just such a car crash. He woke up in locked-in syndrome. That's a medical condition when you cannot move a single muscle in your body. And the book describes the weeks and the months that he lived in that condition. But it describes what he was feeling. He describes the nurses. Some were kind and sweet. Some were when he called Attila the Hun. But it goes through what he was feeling during those weeks. The interesting part about the story was he was locked in, but he still could move one muscle. He could blink his left eye. A speech pathologist devised a method for him to communicate. She put the alphabet on a card going down, and she would move her finger down the card. When she got to a letter that he wanted to signal, he would blink his eye and she would write it down. So here's the question. That man in that hospital bed, in that state, was he alive? So if you're not sure whether he was alive or not, let's focus on one fact. That book that was a bestseller in France, translated into English, was written by that man in that state. You see, in the mornings, he would compose the sentences and the paragraphs in his mind. In the afternoon, his secretary would stand at the foot of his bed, taking dictation letter by painstaking letter, because he died in that state. And if you like an illustration of a man being vibrantly alive while his body is effectively dead, take a look at that book. But you know why that's a big yisod, gentlemen? You ever come to a Shabbos, and it's, wow, you feel the kedusha of Shabbos. Maybe it's Yom Kippur, maybe it's a Kosel. And it's almost strange, because here I am, this physical entity, kind of temporarily having this spiritual experience. It almost feels unnatural. Well, gentlemen, nothing could be further from the truth. You are not a physical entity and temporarily having a spiritual experience. The essence of you are completely, utterly spiritual. You're temporarily having a physical experience. You're put into this goof for a few years, and you're around for a little while, but when you're done your job here, the body's put in the ground, and then you separate. So, in any case, when I spent a lot of time on this subject, I spent a lot of time discussing this. This elderly man came over to me afterwards and said, "Rabbi, according to what you've just said, I've wasted my entire life." And I said to him, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, this idea that Hashem created us to grow and accomplish, that Hashem put us here to change the essence of us, that every conversation with another person shapes me, molds me, and every time I act in a certain way, it makes me forever, I've never thought about that. And according to what you're saying, I wasted my entire life." Now, gentlemen, here's the observation. This was in a frum shul. The man wore a yarmulke. The man put on tefillin every day. The man was 80 years of age, and this question never crossed his conscious mind. Meaning the following. He recognized Hashem created the world, the heavens and the earth and all that it contained. But he never said, "Oh, wait a minute, I get it. Hashem made the sky, the moon, the sun, the stars, and Hashem made me. Maybe there's a reason. Yeah. Doggone! Maybe Hashem put me here for a reason." It never crossed his conscious mind. But gentlemen, do you understand what I'm saying? If you wake up when you're 80 and you say, "Gee golly, maybe there's a tachlis, maybe there's a reason," it's a little late in the game. Had he woken up at 60, had he woken up at 40, had he woken up at 20, don't you think he would have made different choices? And don't you think he would have made different life decisions? And again, the reason I say that to you guys is because you guys have a unique opportunity, which probably you'll never have again. Most people, when they hit a certain age, if it's 25, if it's 30, certainly by 35, whatever track in life they're on, they're stuck. If it's this way, it's great. If it's that way, it's okay. And if it's whatever, then it's whatever. Do you know what whatever means? Ask a 20-year-old today, outside the Dalet Kosos of Beis Medrash, the following question. What do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to be? Yeah, what do you want to be? And what do you want to accomplish? What do you want to accomplish, do? I don't, whatever, you know. I'll make a little money, spend the money, make a little more money, then we die. Whatever, you know? Whatever. No, but what do you aspire to? What do you dream about? What do you want to become? I don't know. Come on, I'll get married, have some kids, make some money, spend the money, make some money, spend the money, and we die. Whatever. So, this may be a shocking reality, but Hashem did not take a human being from under the Kisei HaKavod, put you into this world for whatever. Hashem put a human being into the world to grow, to accomplish, and what a human being can accomplish is vast beyond our understanding. And I want to share one more thought, because I think this thought is maybe one of the most important ones. Since you're probably about maybe 10 years old, there's a Mishnah that you've had a question on. It's a Mishnah that says that Yofa Sha'achas B'tshuva U'masim Tovim Mikol Chayolam Haba. 1 hour, 1 moment of tshuva and ma'asim tovim is better than all of Olam Haba. And you've wondered about that mission. It makes no sense. Hashem created Olam Haba for one reason. For us to enjoy unending benefit, unending pleasure, and pleasure upon pleasure, whiffs upon whiffs. How is it possible that 1 hour of tshuva and ma'asim tovim can be better than all of Olam Haba? It makes no sense. You'd like to know what the answer to that is? Sheldon Adelson, who was a Jewish businessman, very successful one. He started the Comdex business show, the computer show. And the show was so large that he had to rent out entire hotels. Eventually he bought a hotel. Eventually he built another hotel. Eventually he became so wealthy he built the Sands and the Venetian hotels in Las Vegas. And Forbes magazine explains that in 2004, Sheldon Adelson was a very, very wealthy man. But then he took the Sands Venetian public. And when he took the company public, from the moment the initial public offering hit the stock market, his personal wealth skyrocketed. He went from being a very wealthy man to the fifth wealthiest man in the world. And Forbes likes to count other people's money, a little bit like a Jewish accountant. And they like to explain to you how other people are doing. So they give us a mushel. If you want to know how much money Sheldon Adelson made in that year and a half, 2004, 2005, they say he made approximately $1 million an hour. Not so bad, $1 million an hour. So I was once sighing to myself, what would it be like to be a balabos and to make $1 million an hour? Okay, you open the Gemara for the Daf HaYomi, you close the Gemara, $1 million richer, whoa! You go for a little dip in a pool, come out $500,000 richer, not bad. Put your head down on the pillow for a schluff Shabbos afternoon, wake up $3 million richer, wow, life is great, this is unbelievable. Could you imagine making $1 million an hour? And now I want to share with you a yesod of life that not a lot of people realize. And being rich is okay. Talk to somebody who's really, really wealthy and ask them, is your life significantly different now that you're really wealthy than it was 20 years ago? Most of the time, people say, not really. I mean, there are conveniences. It's very convenient to be able to buy different things. But the quality of life is not significantly different. But if you ask the same person, what about when you were getting rich? Wow, it was a blast. Another million and another million. Getting rich is tremendously joyful. And you know why? Because it feels almost like growth. I'm richer, and I'm getting richer, and I'm getting richer and richer. But once you get rich, you realize it's not really what it's cracked out to be. Would you like to know what pshat in this Mishnah is? The greatest pleasure the human being can have. We don't view it now. But when we leave this earth, when my body's put in the ground, and I separate, and I'm standing in a shemayim, and I'm looking down, I'll understand the value of one word of learning, I'll understand the value of one chesed, I'll understand the value of one time closing my mouth and not saying what I wasn't supposed to say. And the value is incredible. It's not $1 million an hour, it's far more. And if you'd like to understand the greatest pleasure you could have in this world, in existence, it's when you're growing and accomplishing. Gentlemen, Kiruv used to be a very difficult job. In the 60s, in the 70s, even the 80s in America, it was a hard job. You know why? Because people were basically happy. Would you like to find me a human being in the United States of America today who's happy? I would like to see the human being. Stand on Fifth Avenue and watch the army of people walk by, and I challenge you to find me this thing called a smile. Find me a human being who's genuinely happy. It almost never happens. And if you're not sure that I'm right, just watch the following. When they advertise teenage clothes, you know, the teenage model, he's wearing the jeans and the t-shirt. Do you ever notice his face? The face looks something like this. Why is it that you never see the model? You know why not? And because the job of the model is to sell the jeans. You buy jeans or a t-shirt from someone you identify with. And the average teenager who sees somebody smiling, who's that? None of my friends smile. None of the people I'm not wearing those kind of clothing. Dorks wear that kind of clothing. No way. And they can't have a teenage model smile because it would be so weird and so uncultural and it wouldn't sell anything. And if you think I'm kidding, I'm not kidding. Stand outside a public high school in the United States of America and watch the expressions of people who exit. And I've done this as a sociological study. Just do it. Count the smiles. They don't happen. They're not there. And you know why? They have everything. And every imaginable thing is permitted. There's no isurim. There's nothing. And that's exactly the point. There's nothing. Would you like to know why there's nothing? Hashem put you on a planet to grow, to accomplish. Hashem gave you a vast and tremendous opportunity. And when you're doing that, there's an inner joy. There's a happiness. There's a deep-seated understanding. I'm steiging. And even if it's difficult, and even if it's a struggle, there's an inner satisfaction. There's an inner happiness. And you know why? Because there really is a joy in your heart. And gentlemen, I want to share with you something. Forget the world to come. If you want to enjoy this world, put yourself as much as you can into mizgeres of a Torah lifestyle. Go in geula, and you'll find something strange. People are actually happy. And go in the mir yeshiva and talk to people, and you see people who are steiging are genuinely happy. And if you're not sure that I'm right, just compare them to people outside. And I go in, I go out, I look here, I look there, and it's such a vast, obvious difference that it's frightening. So what I'm saying to you is forget the world to come. If you want to enjoy this world, if you're steiging, that's what Hashem created you for, you're happy, you're growing, there's an inner sense of peace, an inner sense of happiness. So do you hear what this Chazal shares with us? What Rebbe Meir did was Mavakish Rachmim. He begged mercy. Hashem, let him burn. Why? Because Gan Eden is worth it. And it's worth being toast for 130 years. But that's not what Hashem wants from us. Hashem doesn't want us to suffer in this world. Hashem created us for the world to come, but there are tremendous pleasures in this world because Hashem is a Meitiv and Hashem wants us to enjoy this world. But to enjoy this world, you have to be growing, you have to be accomplishing. And what this Chazal shares with us is that the greatest growth that a human being can accomplish is in Limud HaTorah. It's a schus that never leaves you, and it's yours forever. And there are two different sugim of people, two different camps. There are regular people, and there are Talmidei Chachamim, and the difference between them is night and day. And for you guys, it's an opportunity. When Yehuda Nasi fell on the floor, it's because at that moment, he understood what he never understood before, the tremendous ashirus that's accessible and available to a regular person. When he becomes a Talmid Chacham, a different sug of person. And for you guys, I think it's a tremendous opportunity and a tremendous chance to make yourself into what you'll be forever. I want to close with one last thought. The Marsha explains that Elisha Menavuya made a mistake. It wasn't when he was choking to Talmidei Chachamim, not when he went over to the prostitute. No. The Marsha says Elisha Menavuya made one mistake. It's when the Bas Kol came out and said, Shuvu Vonim Shovavim, says the Marsha, he learned wrong pshat in the Pasuk. And see, the Pasuk says, Shuvu Vonim Shovavim. Hashem says, if you return, take one step, I'll push from behind, I'll provide the wind. And Hashem says, take one little opening, and I'll push the rest of the way. There's a special Siyat Rishmaya. The Bas Kol was saying, Elisha Menavuya, you lost that. For a Tana to be coming up, Bikoros is so egregious that you've lost that special help, that's gone. But says the Marsha, Ein Dover Omed Bifnei Tshuva. There is nothing that prevents a person from doing tshuva. Meaning to say, that Elisha Menavuya just woken up at that moment, he could have changed, he could have returned, and that, says the Marsha, was his one mistake. And if you'd like to understand what that mistake means, I'll make it very clear. The name Rebbe Meir is mentioned 363 times in Mishnayos. The name Rebbe Meir is mentioned 1,197 times in Talmud Bavli. The name Elisha ben Avuya is mentioned once in all of Mishnayos and Gemara. You know what that means? Elisha ben Avuya was the Rebbe of Rebbe Meir. What he was so astonishingly great that it's hard to imagine. But when he was done Gehenim and he was put into Gan Eden, he wasn't a sliver of a fraction of a sliver of what he had been. Because who he was no longer. And yes, he has some chelik in Gan Eden, but not a fraction of what he could have been. And gentlemen, I think the moral of the story is very clear. You guys have an opportunity to accomplish worlds that are beyond your ability to understand. If we could clearly see it, there would be no Bechira. If you would see the wealth, the accomplishments of one afternoon Seder, one morning Seder, there would be no free will, and of course, that can't be. So we're blinded by Taiva, by darkness, by blackness, whatever. Open the Gemara, close the Gemara, whatever. How important is it? Does it really matter? Come on, I learn another Masechta. I stay in Israel another year. What's the big deal? Does it really matter? Is it going to change my life? And gentlemen, that's exactly the point. There's such a darkness. Because if there was clarity, if there was reality, there'd be no free will. But the reality is that you guys have an opportunity to change your life, to make yourself into. And the only thing that Hashem is mavakesh is a true effort. You daven to Hashem, you ask, and you put the brain on, and you say, I'm worth the struggle, I'm worth the battle. You enjoy this world, you enjoy the world to come. And Hashem grant you much hatzlach and bracha. I also want to mention there's a book, Stop Surviving, Start Living, that's available. It's the first parak of Masil Sharm written in 21st century language. I spent, I don't know, maybe 25 years teaching, learning and teaching the first parak, and then sat down to write it. And I really you know, if you find that Musa Zeta works for you, you know, if you open a Mesillah Sharm and you're crying and you're into it and you work out so enthusiastic, and well, so you probably don't need the book. But assuming that Musa Zeta sometimes is good, sometimes not, I highly recommend, take a look at the book. Again, it makes the first paragraph real. You'll also find I stole some of the material from the shmooze. I stole from the book. It's plagiarizing, but no one's gonna arrest me, I think. Much hatzlacha. My son's outside selling it for you.